Hi, everybody. My name is Luke, and I am an alcoholic. And thanks, Billy, for asking me to come out. It's an honor to be here. I am grateful to do anything for Alcoholics Anonymous. I believe that I'm only alive today because of AA and because someone took the time to explain things to me, So whenever I'm asked to do anything, I've been taught to say yes, and I'm grateful to do that. I will say, though, that speaking is not at the top of the list of things I would choose, It's actually pretty close to the bottom, There's like cigarette butts, speaking, And then it's like trash, Like trash, cigarette butts, speaking. Or like helping someone move on your day off, something like that, But like I said, I do, this is kind of wobbly, scary, but anyway, I do love AA, and like I said, I'm grateful to be here, and I am an alcoholic. I mean, that means a couple things. It means I can't control, the amount I drink. When I start drinking, I'm not in control. That doesn't necessarily mean that I'm going to get a DUI that night or get arrested or something awful like that's going to happen. It just means I can't tell you what's going to happen. And there's nights those things will happen, and there's nights they may not, but I'm not what's in control. Once I put a little alcohol in my body, something else takes over. And the other thing that makes me alcoholic is that for any good reason not to take a drink, no matter what the consequences were, no matter how bad things got, no matter how much someone loves me and stands in the way of a drink, I can always justify taking a drink, and I always drink again. No matter how good of a reason I have not to, and that's been my experience. So, I guess getting into my story, if there is a poster child for like a normal kid, I don't know what a normal kid is, but if there's like a measuring stick for what a kid should be when he's, when they're kids, what normal would be? I'm not that measuring stick, I'm the farthest thing from that measuring stick that you could find. I always liked doing things more after I was told not to do them, and my mom, she loved me to death, she tried to give me everything, that parents try to give their kids, and I had a loving family. I have two sisters that have never been arrested, so I can't blame, my alcoholism on anything, and if anything, new people might relate with this, that kind of drives me crazy. When you're feeling crazy or you're feeling restless or irritable and you want a drink and you have no reason, you have nothing to pin it on. That's the worst feeling in the world, because you think no one understands, and that's how I felt. I wouldn't have been able to tell you that when I was a toddler, because I didn't know anything else. But, I could tell you that after I drank, I realized I was missing something, And growing up, I was the kind of kid who, when all the other kids in class were doing, trying to do well and get an A, or they were waiting all day till recess to kick a damn kickball around, or they were all excited about it, I was, going through the teacher's purse trying to steal things or, stuff like that. And I was just a weird kid, I was different. People talk about feeling different. I don't know that I felt different, but I just was. I was very different, And I would, when kids were out playing sports, I would want to go to the swamp and catch, critters that you're not supposed to catch. My mom would put these aquariums out on her deck, for me to put these creatures in, like snakes and turtles and stuff. But I would always fill those up, so I would bring them in the house, and my mom would come home and have snapping turtles in her bathtub, or, I put a black snake in her washing machine one time, Like stuff like that, I was just a little terror. I have memories of, I set the woods on fire, I think, when I was seven. My mom had the fire department come out to give me a scare, like they brought the fire truck and, took me outside and talked to me about the dangers of playing with matches, and all the neighborhood kids were just watching, like, what happened, And I loved it, man. I felt like this is all for me. Like, this is all for me, just loved attention any way I could get it, when I was eight, I got caught having porn mags in the treehouse, my mom made my dad tear down the treehouse, and she made me watch her burn them, It's just, eight was a rough year, I was just a little different, and I always got in trouble in school, and I loved that kind of excitement, just getting in trouble. And I guess another thing, whenever I was in trouble, which is pretty much all the time. My mom would send me up to stay with my dad, who he owned a couple bars in Baltimore City, and she would just drop me off late at night when he was bartending, drop me off at the restaurant, you know, and she would give me this speech, you know, that was just an awful speech, you know. She'd say, "You better get used to that awful smell in there," you know. She's like, "'Cause that's where you're heading," you know. And the smell she was referring to is cigarettes, beer, you know, that type of thing. I don't know. I think we can all agree that those aren't bad smells, you know, like to me. And, you know, I loved it. You know, I remember, you know, being a young kid in the bar, and I thought the alcohol looked beautiful, you know, and, you know, women with hardly any clothes on, and just, I just loved being in the bar at 8 years old, you know. But I would say, you know, my mom would say that, and I'd be like, "No, I don't want to do that," you know, but I was just lying, you know. I was like, you know, ready to get in there, you know, and I could see alcohol was doing something for these people, you know, these people just seemed happy, like they were having a good time, and they loved everybody, and that's what it looked like to a kid like me, you know, is that, you know, alcohol did something, and I had actually just found out about this recently. You know, when I went to the bar, like, people would just let me take sips off their drinks and stuff like that when I was a little kid, and I apparently loved it. I don't even remember that, you know, but I think I've never had a normal relationship with alcohol or anything like that. I've always been attracted to it, and I was always in trouble, like I said, and I got in trouble long before I drank. I got in trouble with the law before I really started drinking, And, you know, I was sent to every therapist, doctor, psychologist, whatever my mom could find. You know, I was medded up from an early age, put on every med you can put a kid, you know. And I don't blame the doctors. You know, if I was a doctor and treating a kid, you know, you try to treat what's wrong, you know, and couldn't pay attention in school, so I was put on those meds, you know. I felt anxious all the time, you know, and you know, I would be happy one minute, really angry the next, you know. That's bipolar, right? You know, so I was put on all these medications that work for those problems, but that wasn't really what I had, you know. So I was always put on medications, always, you know, being, you know, they were always trying to find out what's wrong with Luke, you know. And I can remember, people say they didn't really know how, you know, off they felt until they drank, and that's kind of true for me, but I have memories of, like, watching TV and seeing, I remember this one commercial very vividly for me when I was a young kid. It was for an anxiety pill, and it was this, like, businesswoman about to walk into, like, this business meeting. Everybody's in suits, and she's just, like, you know, so nervous, like, you know, freaking out, and it was, like, anxiety, and this pill takes it away, and I saw that commercial, I was like, that's what I need, you know what I mean? I don't think 9-year-old kids feel that way most of the time, you know, and I knew something wasn't right, and I was always getting in trouble, and when I finally, you know, got drunk for the first time, it was like my world turned upside down, and, you know, something happened, and the lights turned on, and it was worth selling my soul for, which I did time and time again. You know, I was on probation at the time. I kind of had a little bit of a crush on my probation officer. You know, she was attractive, and that scared me. You know what I mean? Of course, attractive women are scary to young boys. They still are, kind of, you know, so, you know, I could never look at her in the eyes and stuff like that, and just afraid of her, you know, and I remember that night, you know, me and my friend were just going to have a beer, you know, and of course, I mean, I know what happens when you drink a lot. You get drunk and you do stupid, my probation officer's coming over, you know, come on, man, you know. And I had one beer, he had one beer, I wanted another, he's like, okay, you know, and somewhere around halfway through the third beer, my perception just changed, you know, like something happened, like I said, that I would cross any line for, you know, and I felt comfortable in my skin, I felt like I wasn't afraid anymore, you know, and we only had a six-pack, you know, so I was at his house at the time, so I just kept going. He was like, we need to stop because you're getting drunk. And I was like, right, you know, and I went to his liquor cabinet when he wasn't looking for the rest of the night and just started, you know, taking shots of vodka for the rest of the night. And I don't really remember much of what the probation officer, that conversation, but I do remember, you know, that I just, she wasn't as attractive in my eyes, you know, or I just didn't care. And she was lucky to be talking to me, you know what I mean? And that was the shift, you know, and that's what alcohol did for me. You know, I'm kind of a you know, like I said, anxious, nervous, and I can remember times of just like being in a group of friends and everybody's laughing and they're telling jokes, you know, and I'm thinking of jokes. I like to think I'm pretty clever, you know, and I'm thinking of funny things to say, but then I have this dilemma also in the back of my head that's like, no, don't say that. You're going to sound stupid. I'm like, oh, but this is funny. I'm going to say it. No, don't say it. You know, everybody's going to know how much of a pervert you are if you say that joke. Do not say that joke, you know, and I was like, no, this is going to be funny, and then someone else says the joke, and everybody laughs, and you're like, ah, I missed it, you know what I mean, and it was just like that all the time, you know, just second guessing myself, and just feeling like I don't fit in here, this isn't right, not feeling right, and alcohol took that away. If it did anything, it made me not care, you know, it made me not care what people thought. Well, that's a great feeling for someone like me who cares so much, you know, what people think about me or how I look or what I'm going to get. I care so much about me, you know, and that's a great feeling to have, you know, and I had a lot of images, you know, throughout my life that I tried to hold up and make people think I was a certain way, and they always changed, you know, but the one thing that stayed was I wanted people to think that I didn't care what you thought about me. You know, I wanted people to think I didn't have a care in the world, but I cared so much, you know, and what people thought about me, kind of, you know, what people thought about me was in my head how valuable I was, you know, which, I mean, isn't true, but, you know, that's the delusion. Those are the kind of delusions I had, you know, and that's why I drank the way I drank, you know, and I still feel today if alcohol did for everybody what it did for me, everybody would have drank the way I drank, you know, and I can think of, you know, a lot of times in my sobriety I can think of times in my drinking, you know, where I crossed lines, you know, to get drunk, where I was sober, you know, I used to say, like, you know, I'd have things I regret, and I'd say, well, I was drunk, but there's things I did when I wasn't drunk. There's things, the things I was the most ashamed of when I came into AA were the things I did between drinks when I was sober, you know, and I can think of a time where my mom was kind of, you know, crying and begging me not to leave the house, and my mom, you know, like I said, loved me, you know, as much as anybody could, you know, and she was begging me not to leave the house, asking me what I need, what can she do for me, you know, and the truth was, the way I saw it was, you know, she was standing between me and what I needed, you know, and I put my hands on my mom and pushed her to the ground, just to get her out of the way so I could get that next drink, you know, and you know, that's one of the things I wouldn't ever tell Soul, you know, I wouldn't ever, especially if I did, I wouldn't tell him I was sober, you know, and that I did it because I needed to drink, but, you know, I have a lot of that in my story, and I'm not proud of that, but that's, you know, that's the kind of monster I am, and that's the kind of person I'll be today, if I leave AA, you know, and I believe that very much, you know, that if, you know, alcoholism doesn't tear my life to shreds, my selfishness will, you know, whether I take a drink of alcohol or not, and I believe that today. So, I don't know, you know, I kept getting in trouble with the law, and my mom, I remember another time, my mom was, you know, kind of just pleading with the judge, saying, you know, that I'm not, you know, like, I'm not a bad kid. They didn't let me go into court. They had me stay in the detention center in a jumpsuit. I had a camera on me, and they, you know, they could watch me in the courtroom, and I saw the judge, and I saw my mom, you know, and it was just, you know, this was not the first time my mom saw me in a jumpsuit, but it was the first time she just broke down, you know, she couldn't, this isn't how any mother wants to see their son, you know, you know, just asking the judge for, you know, the opportunity to try to get me some help, you know, and you know, that's what happened, you know, I was court ordered to, you know, first to military school, and I made this commitment with myself, I'm going to be good, I'm going to follow the rules so I can get home, I'm going to stop disappointing my parents, I'm going to stop, you know, stop tearing people's lives apart, and I went to military school, and it wasn't long before I, you know, that restlessness kind of kicks in, you know, and when you don't have any booze in you, and I find people who know how to get it, and, you know, people who are doing the things that I like to do, and it wasn't long till they, you know, they kicked me out, and I was court ordered there, and so I had, you know, more charges on me, I had to go back to detention, and then, you know, I was sent somewhere else, and that's kind of how it went, and I was sent out of the state of Virginia, so I wouldn't get any more charges in Virginia, which is a blessing today, because I did get charges in Utah, and that would have been bad, you know, if I got more in Virginia, because I already had a violation of probation and a long list of things, you know, that they were waiting to see what happens when Luke turns 18, you know what I mean? And it wasn't looking good. My future wasn't looking good, that's for sure. And, you know, so they sent me out to this treatment center out in Utah, and it was like on the brochure it would say, like, therapy with animals, like every kid gets his own horse, and they take care of this horse, and they, you know, move hay bales and shovel crap, and, you know, that's what they do. You know, they take care of horses, and I guess that helps your alcoholism. I don't know. It didn't do much for me. I got there, and I didn't even get a horse. They gave me a water buffalo to take care of. You know, so felt different again, you know, and I was losing my mind there, you know, and that's like the truth is about my drinking, and this can still, you know, get to my head today if I'm not working with a lot of newcomers and you know, if I ever forget what alcoholism really is, you know, truth, my drinking's kind of pitiful, man. It always got interrupted, you know, like I would get snatched out of my bed in the middle of the night by two huge guys with handcuffs and taken to a treatment center, you know, and drinking always got interrupted, and that, it sucks, I tell you, you know, being under 18 and trying to be an alcoholic, you know, but I got sent to this place, and I remember just being thirsty, you know, I just losing my mind, and I made the same commitment I made everywhere else, and I'm going to do what I have to do, and follow the rules and get home, be, you know, whatever, I'm gonna follow the rules, and you know, that restlessness kicks in, and something's not right, and I need a drink, you know, and I remember, you know, it talks about in our book a couple times, it talks about no matter, like, how smart we are, how clever we think we are, of course, I'm paraphrasing, but, you know, it talks about how the foolish idea always wins out, you know, and that's kind of what I'm talking about, like, no matter how many good reasons I have not to drink, all that, you know, and all the evidence, all the knowledge of my condition can easily be pushed aside for the foolish idea that it won't hurt me if I mix whiskey with milk. You know what I mean? Something like that. You know, the foolish idea always wins out. And it did for me. And I remember being at this place for like a couple weeks, and one of the staff members, just this cowboy guy, saying, you know, it's in the middle of the Utah desert, and he said, a lot of people have tried to run away from here, and a lot of people have died, you know, and anybody hearing that would think, that I'm not going to run away, you know, and I thought, a lot of people, someone's made it, you know, and I'm a soldier, you know, if anybody's going to make it, it's me, and, you know, and because I'm really smart, and so I ran away in the middle of the night with no food, no water, no plan, because I'm smart, you know, and it was in the middle of the desert. I remember just walking through the desert with my mouth so dry, and, you know, I felt like I had cotton balls in my mouth, and I was wearing contact lenses at the time, felt like little pieces of sandpaper, you know, just like so thirsty, and you know, not sleeping, because it gets real cold at night. You don't want to sleep, you know, and it was real hot in the day, and I'm just walking through the desert. I was there for 3 days, and I made it to the nearest town. I didn't die, obviously, and I was, you know, walking, like, just, you know, I would get the thought of, like, you know, when I feel like I can't go on anymore, I would just think of, I'm a Coors guy, you know, and I would think of that silver bullet, you know, and I would think about just, like, cold beer with, like, condensation on the side, just how it feels when it hits your lips, the smell, you know, and my mouth would water just enough, you know, and I would keep hiking, you know, and I was so excited, and I made it to the nearest town, and then cop cars just swarmed around me, you know, and they ran out and slammed me down and, you know, zip-tied me and brought me back to my treatment center, and I was just dying, you know, and so angry, and I think I made a joke to one of the officers, you know, like, how about a beer, and he didn't even respond, you know, who is this kid, you know, and it's kind of a funny story, I guess, you know, but the truth, I didn't really know the truth about that story until I started making some amends, and one of the things my big sister told me when I made amends was, you know, how those 3 days I was out in the desert, my mom didn't sleep, you know, for those 3 days. She was just staying up at night by the phone waiting for a call to tell her son was dead, you know, and I was the kind of person who either didn't care or thought that I was only hurting myself, you know, I'm only hurting myself, and I didn't realize the kind of damage I was causing, you know, and More so than all the money I stole from my parents, I stole their peace of mind. I stole, you know, my mom's ability to sleep at night, and long before I stole that, I stole, you know, parents love to talk about their kids, you know, they love to brag about their kids, and my mom didn't really have much to brag about with me, you know, so, you know, I stole that from my parents, and also, you know, on the third day, my mom had to get some kind of dental surgery, root canal or something, I don't know what, and apparently she wouldn't let the dentist put her under, because she said she's waiting on an important phone call, and that was me, and that's actually when she did get the call. That's when they found me, and the dentist answered the phone and said, they found your son, you know. But, you know, that's just the kind of damage I caused. I had no idea. And that's what I'm talking about, this selfishness, you know. I just want to feel good all the time, and I'll do anything, too. And no amount of love would have kept me sober because, you know, if it could, I would never have drank, you know. So, I don't know, I guess after that I got sent to another place out in the wilderness, you know, where you had to, you know, learn how to make fire with sticks and, you know, stuff like that, and I was there for a couple months, and like a lot of people talk about this, a lot of people in my home group, when they speak, they talk about the feeling of relief when they know that the madness is going to stop for a period of time, you know, and a couple guys in my home group felt that way when they got, like, sentenced, you know, they would go to jail, and when the bars would slam shut, most people are scared, you know, and, you know, but I think a lot of us are, you know, have feel relieved, you know, because I won't be able to drink right now, for at least the time being, the madness is going to stop, and that's how I felt out in the middle of the woods. I knew there was only so much damage I could cause out there, you know, so I don't know, I was there for, you know, a couple months, And then, you know, what happened was I got court ordered to one last place. While I was out in Utah, I also got an assault charge. So, like I said, it was good I wasn't in Virginia, because that would have, you know, been another violation, and I wouldn't have ever gone to this place out in New York. But I did, and I guess the big thing that was different was that they had they had big books on every shelf out here at this place in New York, and I was there for 33 months. I was court ordered there. I guess at the time they could court order someone until they were 19, meaning I could leave when I was 18, but I wasn't going home. You know, I was I'd go to jail, so you know, I had to be there till I was 19, and then there were big books on every shelf, and if you were ever in trouble, which I always was, they made you sit in the corner, like face the corner, and read a program book. And a program book is something anonymous, you know, like, you know, AA, NA, EA, something, you know, something A. And I just read the stories in the back, you know. Nowhere in my brain did I thought I was alcoholic, you know. I knew something was wrong. I mean, that was, any idiot looking at my life would say, something's wrong, you know, but I didn't know what. I wouldn't have said alcoholism. I wouldn't have said anything like that. I would have said, I have a list of all these problems. Alcohol makes me feel a little better in the meantime while I try to figure all the rest of this crap out. You know, that's kind of, you know, what I would have articulated if I had the vocabulary to. You know, but I remember reading the stories in the back, and I remember when I started reading, you know, part of the big book, I just kind of identifying really with the feelings, you know, the feelings of how I feel when I'm sober, you know, and what alcohol does for me. And it talks in the doctor's opinion about being restless, irritable, and discontented, unless we can again experience the sense of ease and comfort, which comes at once by taking a few drinks which we see others taking with impunity. And I knew what that meant. You know, I didn't have a vocabulary to say that, restless, irritable, and discontented, but I know what that means to my core, you know. And they would give me suggestions, you know, when I would go home, they would, you know, tell me to try to help out with my family, and they would try to, you know, to just kind of have some kind of community spirit, try to be helpful, and you know, those things kind of helped me. I'd never been useful to anybody in my entire life, you know, so, you know, the service, you know, kind of, you know, cleared my head. I was there, like I said, I was there for a while, and when I left, you know, I guess the transformation that needs to happen in a treatment center, the whole point of a treatment center is, A, you know, they introduced me to Alcoholics Anonymous, and B, you know, my head kind of, you know, I sobered up, my head kind of cleared enough so that AA became an option when I left, whereas before I went there, it wasn't. But you know, I left there and I wanted to just do well. I wanted to be a good son, you know, and a good brother, a good worker. I had plans, you know, just to be a good guy, you know, but I didn't really know how to do that, but I didn't know how to do that. And I left this treatment center and you know, I would go to a couple meetings and I just related out, you know. It was really easy for me to do that, you know, and I think it is for anybody if they look for good reasons, you know. I thought I was too young or too this, too that, and, you know, it's funny, I sponsor two guys who think they're too old, you know, so it's funny, you know. We'll always find, at least I will, I'll always find some reason I'm different, you know. And the biggest thing that killed me, I think, looking back on it now, was I had this mentality or this ego that said, you know, I'm a graduate of this treatment center. You know, I'm not just an alcoholic. I went here and I know more. I've been sober two and a half years, you know, but I really didn't, you know. None of that was really true. And I stopped going to these meetings but you know, I still had every intention of staying sober and being, you know, living, you know, differently. And I remember my big sister invited me to a 4th of July party. I'd been out of this treatment center for 10 days. It was at James Madison University. I got sober in Stanton. And I told her, I said no, because I knew there would be drinking there. And I didn't go. You know, I wanted to be sober. And by the end of the night, I was down in my basement taking shots, you know, just trying to quiet the madness, you know. And the truth is, you know, whenever that madness is on, that uncomfortability, and I want to drink, there is no winning that argument, you know. Like I said, I drink no matter what. And I had every good reason not to drink at that time, you know. But to me, you know, I kind of, a foolish idea won again. You know, it was a couple of them. I remember where my thinking went. You know, it was just like, this is stupid. You're a loser. All your friends are out drinking. Why are you different? You know, why can't you just drink like everybody else? You know, all those thoughts. And then I would think, well, what's the use anyhow? You're going to drink eventually, you know, and I would just start drinking. And, you know, another one was, it's been 33 months. You are well overdue for a drink, you know. And I will tell you, the thought I didn't have was it's going to be different this time. I actually didn't have that thought this time. You know, I thought this is probably going to be bad. You know, and it talks about that in our book too. You know, it talks about, you know, being without defense against the first drink, being unable at certain times to bring into consciousness, with sufficient force, the memory of the suffering and humiliation of even a week or a month ago, let alone 33 months ago, you know. And it doesn't say I'm not going to remember. I used to mistake that. It says I can't bring it into my consciousness with sufficient force, meaning it's minuscule, you know. It's minuscule. The damage I caused, the memory of that last drink, compared to my feelings today, it's minuscule. You know, because my feelings today are the most paramount thing in my life, you know, and that needs to be taken care of. So I started drinking, you know, and wasn't really a bad night, you know, by any standard of compared to, you know, my drinking. But it was emotionally a bad night, you know, obviously. You know, the next morning waking up thinking I've been sober 33 months and threw it away without making a decision to, you know, like it was obvious I didn't have the decision. And I guess by chance I had a friend who was sober up in the area I'm sober now, and he invited me to come up and stay with him. He must not have been talking to his sponsor at the time, because that was a bad idea, you know. But I'm glad he wasn't, because I'm sober. So, you know, I went up and stayed with this guy at his parents' house and you know, just kind of hanging out. And, you know, the one thing he said was, you know, you're welcome to stay with me, but I go to a meeting every day, so you're going to have to come with me to meetings. And I said, you know, that's fine, man. I'll support you, you know, I'm a good guy, you know. So I went with him to meetings, and that's where I met my sponsor. He picked me up for my first meeting back, he picked us up and he was, you know, talking to me about alcoholism and that type of thing, and, you know, told him I was an alcoholic, went to the meeting, and, you know, he shared, and I identified, and I opened up to him, you know, and I believe that's, you know, that's one of the most important things today, is that identification. And that's what happened, you know, like my whole life was told good ideas by well-meaning people, you know, like to stop drinking or stop doing drugs or, you know, you get your act together in school, stop hurting your family, all these great things, you know, that are great advice, but I would always just say, you know, those people don't understand, you know, and truth be told, they really didn't, you know, because they didn't have the same relationship with alcohol, but this guy did, and he described what alcohol did for him and how he felt when he was sober and those type of things, and I related, you know, and I think it's because of that, like, you know, it says in the book, he spoke my language, and because of that, you know, I was willing to listen to directions this guy gave me, you know, listen to him when he told me to do certain things or give me suggestions, you know. You know, and I started going to meetings and I started listening to this guy and I wasn't, you know, I'm not someone who just kind of took off here by any stretch of the imagination. You know, I went to meetings and, you know, I would go in and I would share my wisdom, you know, in the club room, and then I would leave as soon as it's over, and I would just go home and just think about drinking, you know, and that was me, but you guys were lucky to have me around, you know, and I felt like a unicorn sometimes, you know, because people would pinch my cheeks and tell me how lucky I am to be sober so young, and I was like, all right, because I never feel different, so that helps a lot, you know, so I felt different again, and I'm just in meetings, just dying, you know, and then, I mean, that's what I was doing, you know, and I wasn't living any differently. I was wondering, you know, why my mom had such a problem with her supporting me while I failed school and that type of thing, you know, like I was just living like a drunk sober. And I remember, you know, but I will say, after that last time I drank, there was a period where I can't really attribute it to anything except God's grace. You hear a lot about that in AA, but there was a period of time where a couple weeks where I didn't think about drinking, you know, where when I was new. But I remember when it came back, that obsession to drink, you know, because people talk about the obsession being removed, and that's you know, that's the miracle here, but, you know, the truth be told, it can always come back, you know, whenever I stop doing the things that are saving my life. But I had a period of grace, you know, where I wasn't obsessing about alcohol. And I remember I moved into the dorms at Bridgewater College, and it was, and again, all my friends were going to a JMU block party, you know. And so my first night in the dorms, and everybody was like, "Why aren't you coming? You gotta, you know, come with us. It's gonna be a blast." And da 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 da. And pretty girls are telling me I should go, you know. And just losing my mind, and I was hopping from meeting to meeting to meeting. You know, I think there was a 5:30 meeting in Fishersville, and then there was like a 7 o'clock in Harrisonburg, and I had to drive down for the 10 o'clock in Stanton. Just kind of, you know, like my wear and wind, like we're gonna make it, you know. And just thirsty, man, you know, and the thing is, you know, I was on my way to that meeting in Stanton, and I called my sponsor, and I was, you know, that was the last meeting of the night. I didn't know what was going to happen after that meeting, you know, because that madness was on, that uncomfortability that I talk about, you know, and the thing about that is, when I feel that way, I never win, you know. I've never felt that uncomfortable or that thirsty and not had to drink, you know. I always end up drinking. When that madness is on, I don't have the choice, and I was scared to death. And I went to this meeting, and I shared honestly, you know, and I said, I kind of just said, it's, you know, this is what I'm thinking, and I really want to drink, and I don't think I can stay sober, type thing, you know. And a bunch of people came and talked to me after, you know, and this guy who I hated in AA, because there's always someone, you know, when you come in, you're just like, I don't like that guy. And this was him, you know. He you know, looked like he didn't shave or shower in a year, you know. And he was very different, you know, than me. And he was like 6'4", and he was scary, you know. And I told my sponsor I didn't like him, and my sponsor told me to stick close to that guy. And I was like, you know, that's awful. I don't think he heard me, but anyway, you know. And he came up and talked to me, and he invited me out to get coffee that night after the meeting. And well, he told me, he said, he asked me, what are you going to do now? And I was like, I don't know, man. And he's like, well, let me rephrase that. He said, are you going to be a sissy and go home? Or are you going to come drink some coffee? And he didn't say sissy. And I said, and this guy carried a gun on him at the same time, so he was very scary. And I said, man, I was thinking about getting some coffee. And I went with this guy to the Waffle Inn or Waffle House or one of the two, and which is all anybody does down there, it seemed to me. But we went there, and this guy just stayed up with me till four in the morning, just talking. And like I said, it wasn't like we identified or, and it wasn't like we were similar. It didn't seem like we'd have much to talk about, but we talked, and he didn't let me leave until I was so tired I couldn't stand up, And I went home, and I remember feeling like I couldn't believe I stayed sober, and that was, that was the first time I really saw, AA working in my life. I took a sponsor suggestion. When I called him before that Stanton meeting, he said, why don't you go to the meeting and share? And I was like, yeah, that's the last thing I want to do, but I did. And that was the first glimmer of hope I got. And I could see, how AA was working in my life, and there's been more since then, and it all comes, the hope doesn't just come to me, it comes as a result of the actions I've taken, based on suggestions that I disagree with, or that I think aren't going to work, it's always a byproduct of the actions I take, and it actually talks in the book, every promise it gives or every glimmer of hope it gives is a conditional statement, if you think about it, the promises, if we are painstaking about this phase of our development, then we'll be amazed before we're halfway through, that's a conditional statement, an if-then statement, and that's true for the third step, we, being all-powerful, we have a new employer who provides what we needed if we stay close to him and perform his work well, and that's been my experience, I've been grateful and blessed so that, when things get rough, instead of taking my stock out of AA and trying to put it in something else that I think is going to fix the problem, I pull closer to AA, and that's been, I think that's why I'm sober today, I think, the only real difference between, the people that I got sober with that are drinking and me, and the people who are sober is the actions we took, I was told very early on that it's not the people that need it that stay sober, it's not the people that want it really that stay sober, because I know today I have a ton of friends who are out there that need it, that really want to be sober, but they aren't, and he said it's the people that do it that stay sober, and that's been my experience, And one of the biggest things, I have a sponsor who, when I'm, something's really wrong in my life and I'm trying to talk to him, I'll go up to him at a meeting and he'll be like, yeah, walk with me. And I'm like, okay, and I'm like telling him, how much of a jerk the girlfriend is, and like, this isn't going right. My mom is just unbearable. He's like, yeah, come on, I'm listening, walk with me. And he'll go start talking to a new guy. You know what I mean? And I'm like, stuff of that. And he'll introduce me to the new guy, and I'm like, trying to talk to my sponsor, but he's talking to the new guy, and then I end up learning about the new guy and talking to the new guy, and then, and then he'll be like, okay, look, walk with me, and we'll go up to another new guy, never listening to what I have to say, or maybe he is, but, and I'm grateful for that, man, I really am, because my problems just aren't that big of a deal, for the most part, and my sponsor gives me his time, he definitely does, but, at the meeting, he's showing me the solution, and that's taking an interest in someone else's life, and I owe that, absolutely I do. There's so many people who just gave me their time, which is the most valuable thing you can give somebody, and as a result of him doing that, I've taken an interest in new people's lives, and that's really where this second step for me comes from, I'm kind of delusional to the point where I think that I'm really not that bad, Like, it talks about insanity in the second step. Like, I'm not really insane, But I can see it in new guys, That guy's insane, I mean, obviously I'm insane, but, I can see, like, like, these new guys would walk in, and they are people I would not bet on. You know what I mean? Like, I would bet against them, you know. Well, you can't say that in AA. That's, you know, blasphemy. But, you know, I'm like, they're not going to make it. These guys are hopeless, you know. And then they start saying sober, and you're like, Jesus, you know, something's working here. And you know, I always think of this one guy who came in. I got asked to speak at a detox. I remember it was a night I didn't want to speak. I didn't want to be there. And he was the guy in the meeting who you hope doesn't come up and talk to you after you speak, you know. And I was speaking, and he comes up to me and just tells me how much he relates. And I was like, yeah, cool, you know. Like, yeah, if you ever want to go to a meeting, give him my number. It's what I've been taught to do, you know. And I got a call the next day. You know, never get a call from this. There's some institutions, like, you just don't get calls from. This guy called me the next day when he got out. And he said, he's like, hey, man, it's Chris. I was like, Chris. He's like, from Washington Adventist. I was like, oh, great. I was like, you're out? And he's like, yeah. I was like, how are things going? He's like, not good, man. I was like, what's wrong? He said, he's like, I just got robbed at gunpoint. I was like, oh, that's awful. He was like, and I was like, are you sober? And he was like, yeah. I was like, well, that's good. He was like, I think I need to get to one of those meetings. And I was like, okay, that's a good idea. Why do you think that? And he's like, well, because since I got out, I, you know, started smoking pot, and I've been drinking and did some PCP and snorted some cocaine. And I was like, see, you're not sober. He was like, no. and to see that guy today, you wouldn't think it, you know. But, you know, so I took this guy to meetings, and he's sober today, you know, and he's just a different person, you know. And there's a ton of stories like that, you know. There's just some knuckleheads that come in, man, and they say, you know, I don't think AA is going to work for me. And you think in your head, it's probably not going to, nothing will work for you, you know. And then you say, well, it worked for me, so why don't you give it a shot, you know. And then you get to just watch and see what happens in these people's lives, you know, that you would have bet against. And that's been an honor, you know, to be able to do that, you know. So. And I started helping people pretty early on, you know, and that's really the when I have the most peace in my life is when I have people that are calling me, you know, and asking me for help, and I'm walking people through this solution that has saved my life, you know, and my sponsor had me do this fourth step, and that was you know, just a list of everything that I felt made me different, you know, all the reasons I thought I couldn't sit with you people in a meeting because I was too low, too bad, you know, or you know, it's just too cool or whatever, you know, and I read this list and you know, and I saw him identify again, you know, he's shaking his head saying, you know, I've done that, or I know someone who's done that, or that's common, you know, or, you know, and never judging me. But I tell you what, a lot of people talk about a weight being lifted off their shoulders, and I don't know if I felt that way. I kind of had a blueprint of how much of a jerk I was, you know. It was on paper now, and that's never a good thing. That's called evidence, you know. But I did have a blueprint of what I didn't want to be like anymore, you know. And you know, with this sixth and seventh step, you know, I'm still just as defective today as I was when I walked in here, you know. I actually have some defects. Maybe I just didn't know they were around, but I feel like they're new, you know what I mean? Like, where'd these come from, you know? And like a new level of self-obsession, you know, just taking it to a new level, you know, like, and it's not something I'm proud of, but I can be on the phone with, you know, someone I sponsor and just be like, yeah, yeah, and then they're like, so what do you think I should do? And you're like, you need to help someone, you know, and you're like, what did you say again, you know, and they have to, you know, like that, and I've definitely been in that obsession, you know, and I've had defects that just, you know, like, continued to cause damage in sobriety, you know. I had just things I wasn't proud of. There were certain parts of my life that I felt like in my meetings I needed to keep a secret from everybody else, you know, because there were just things I wasn't proud of, you know, like, just a lot of things, you know, and my experience has been that I need, it's kind of abstract, and in the book, Sixth and Seventh Steps, about two paragraphs long, you know, so what do you really do here? You say this prayer and that's it, you know, and that's kind of true, you know. I definitely pray, for God to remove these defects, and, you know, cause I can't remove them myself, and I want to elaborate on that, cause you hear people say that a lot, like, I can't remove my defects, that's God's job, and that is a 100% true statement, but I've also used that as a cop-out. Like, I don't need to do anything different then. You know, God's going to do it. You know what I mean? So on with the money and women. You know what I mean? But what I can do is when I say this prayer, I can act as if God removed those. I can try to act the way God wants me to. And I can direct my attention to someone else. I can help. I can be 100% honest with my sponsor, and I can take that a step further and share about these defects honestly to help someone else. You know, and that's always been a turning point for me. When I'm willing to share that experience of those things that I've messed up or those things I'm ashamed of, things have gotten better for me, you know. And my sponsor got me in, you know, I wrote this 8-step and part of becoming willing is trying to be different. You know, I'm someone who says sorry to everything, you know, whenever the heat's on, oh, I'm sorry, you know, oh, my bad, I'm sorry, it won't happen again. And then it happens again, oh, I'm sorry. You know, I need to do more than say I'm sorry at this point, you know. And, and he had me go back and start making these amends. And I talked about, you know, I made amends, and the reaction is always one I don't think I'm really going to get, you know. Not that I think I'm going to get my head bashed in or anything like that, you know, but I've been amazed, you know. I've had, people tell me their real impression of me, you know, because like I said, it matters so much what I think people think about me, and I'm so wrong so often, you know. Like, I didn't know that both my sisters, my little sister and my big sister, looked up to me, you know, or that they felt like they could depend on me at any time now. I had no idea, and I wouldn't have unless I went back and made that amends, you know. And but like I said, I started living differently and making these living amends long before I started, you know, I actually went back and apologized. And you know, like my sponsor had me start doing the dishes every time I went home, you know, and I would have talks with my sponsor about how, you know, my mom and I are fighting again, you know, and she's just unreasonable, you know, and not thinking about all the damage I caused. And I remember my first Mother's Day sober, I was living up in Maryland, and he said, "What are you doing for Mother's Day?" And I said, "I don't know. I was going to get a card, but I didn't get around to it, you know." And he said, "Well, that's fine. Why don't you just go get some flowers and drive down and surprise your mom, you know?" And I was like, "That's a long way to drive for some flowers, you know." I said, "Okay, though." And I went down and I walked in my mom's kitchen, and she turned around and screamed so loud and punched me in the chest, you know, and surprise, success, you know, and she thought someone was robbing her, you know. And I told my sponsor I surprised her, you know. So that's what I do now. I always try to bring my mom flowers on Mother's Day. And I remember my third Mother's Day sober, I was at a watch the night before, which is something we have whenever someone's about to have a year. We stay up with them till midnight and sing happy birthday. We watch them, make sure they don't screw up on this, you know what I mean? Time's ticking, and we got a lot riding on this, you know, and so it's fun, you know. It's kind of something, you know, for new people to go to, and it's proof it works, you know. You get to see someone stay sober. But I was at this watch I was miserable at this point. You know, I was unemployed. I just bought this awesome new car and got fired the next day. And I was just in bad shape, and I was broke. I had no money. You know, I didn't have enough money to put gas in my car to get to Stanton. Definitely didn't have enough money to buy flowers, you know. And I told my sponsor, you know, this year I'm just not going to be able to make it happen, you know. And he said, "Make it happen," you know. And I know what that means, you know, is you'll walk through the desert to get a drink, get your mom some damn flowers, you know. But I didn't say that, because I just said okay. And I went around and I begged for money at this watch. You know, I panhandled some money at an AA party, and I was just asking, you know. A bunch of my friends gave me a couple bucks here, a couple bucks there, so I could buy my mom some flowers, you know. And then another one of my friends, mom actually lives in this area down in Charlottesville. He was going down to see his mom for Mother's Day and said that after that we could drive across the mountain and bring my mom some flowers. And, you know, so we did that. And when I pulled in the driveway, my mom pulled in behind me, and I got out, and she just had this smile on her face, you know. And she said, "I knew you'd be here." And I said, "I know, Mom. I was trying to surprise you." And she said, "The only way you could surprise me today is if you didn't show up." You know, and that's thanks to my home group for that, you know, for buying my mom flowers and taking me to give them to her, you know. Definitely doesn't have anything to do with me, you know, and that's been, that's been my experience around here the whole time, you know, is I'm willing to listen to someone else's ideas and good things just happen, you know, and my life's very different today than it ever was, you know, and the truth is I live different, you know, I try to take an interest in other people's lives. I have friends, I'm a member of, you know, my home group, and what I mean by that is I contribute, you know, and I try to be there every week, you know, it's, you know, things like this. My home group's going on right now, you know, but, you know, other than a commitment like this, you know, I'm there, and I'm actually the speaker getter for my home group. We have a guest speaker every, the first of every month, you know, and so I always have a job, you know, and I try to take the same principles into, you know, the rest of my life, and I am not good at that, you know, I fall short all the time, you know, but, honestly, my biggest fear, like I kind of talked about, is people, talking to people, and that's now my job, you know, I'm in sales, and, you know, they sick me on, they put me on this, I have to go to, like, sometimes I have to go to bars or something, and I have to try to get all these business cards and talk to everybody, you know, and I always call, like when I was new, my sponsor couldn't keep me out of bars and places like that, you know, and now I just hate going there, you know, I want to be at my meeting, but, you know, I talk to my sponsor, my company pays for me to go, you know, this is my job, I go, I talk to people, I get business cards, which is kind of a big deal for somebody who's afraid of people, you know, but I do that, and then, you know, I always try to get to my meeting if I can, you know, but, you know, I'm at this place, and I'm thinking about all my friends having fun, you know, or laughing at a meeting, or, you know, who's leading, you know, things like that, you know, and when I was new, that was not what I wanted, you know, I would think, you know, people would say things like, everything good in my life today is a result of AA, and I would think, what a loser, you know, and it's so true today. My whole life is surrounded by AA, you know, and I love it, you know, and if there's anything that I would have wanted when I was new, I would have told you I just want like a lifetime supply of cigarettes and maybe a cool car or something, you know, and I just sold myself so short, you know, I don't even smoke anymore, so that wouldn't have been, but anyway, you know, like if I could really pinpoint one thing I wanted is I wanted to feel comfortable in my own skin, you know, and I do for the most part today, you know, except when there's things I need to talk about, and there is right now, you know, there's some things that are on my mind, some resentments, you know, fears, the same kind of things that crop up, and what I try to do is I, you know, put pen to paper, I write them down, I go over them with my sponsor, you know, and I, you know, ask God to help me do better and try to direct my attention to someone I can help, you know, and that's what I do today, and the biggest joy I have is not just, you know, going through these amends, but taking the guys I sponsor through these amends, you know, and seeing them get back together with their families, you know, these hopeless situations or these relationships that can never be repaired, and see them return to their families and see them, you know, just kind of take off in life, you know, and have lives that, you know, we don't deserve, and like I said, you know, with my family, you know, I show up. This summer's actually been pretty exhausting, you know, like I don't usually get service at meetings on the weekends because I'm never there, you know, except my home group, you know, I've been out of town almost every weekend for, you know, my sister's wedding or, you know, something with my family, and while it's been exhausting, it is such a privilege, you know. I tell you, what I'm not today is the person where, you know, that they just expect not to show up, you know. I absolutely show up, and that is, you know, and I try to, you know, I'm not the best worker at work. I don't know where I get it, but I think, you know, I really deserve a great paying job, but not have to do a damn thing for it, you know. And I'm ridiculously lazy, you know, it's kind of sickening, you know, but every now and then the heat gets turned up, and, you know, like, you know, my boss says, we need a little more, you know what I mean, we need some more deals in the pipeline or whatever, you know, and I work real hard for a week so I can be lazy again for a month, you know, and, like, things like that that you don't feel good about, you know, so, I mean, it's definitely a work in progress, but I tell you, I've had a job, the same job, for a year and a half. I couldn't hold a job at Safeway for 2 weeks when I got sober, right? But I've had this, that's a grocery store, I guess you guys don't have it down here, but, you know, I couldn't hold a job for 2 weeks, and I've had the same job for a year and a half, And I can tell you one thing, like, I am where I say I'm going to be when I say I'm going to be there. And if I'm not, I call. But that hasn't really happened, you know. I go to early morning events in Baltimore and D.C., which it's hell to get in there in the morning, you know. But I get there on time, you know. I'm where I say I'm going to be. You know, I had a review at work recently where my boss, you know, kind of told me things I need to do better, no surprises there, you know, things that, you know, I'm doing really well at. And the one that was, you know, that I do the best is I'm where I'm supposed to be, you know, and I'm someone who can't show up, you know, no matter what. And so thank you guys, you know, for my sobriety and teaching me these things, you know, so that I can have some kind of comfort in my life, you know. Because like I said, you know, my life is nothing like what I would have wanted when I was new, but it is far more than I deserve. So thanks for asking me to come out.